Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Music. My name is Franz Nicolai. My guest today is Lily Hirsch. Lily Hirsch is a musicologist, writer, visiting scholar at Cal State Bakersfield. Previously, she was an assistant professor of music at Cleveland State University. She studied music history as an undergraduate at the University of the Pacific, earned her PhD in musicology from Duke. She's the author of books about music during the Nazi era, as well as one about music and criminal law. Her book, Weird Al Seriously, is out this spring in an expanded edition. Lily Hirsch, welcome to New Books in Music.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I wanted to start with your personal relationship to Weird Al and his work. I was sort of surprised towards the end of the book to hear that you weren't a big Weird Al fan before you wrote it. So how did you end up on this topic?
Well, that's a great question. And that wasn't something I was sure I should reveal initially when I was first working on the book. But in the expanded edition, I really get a little more personal and talk about how this all happened and how I consider myself a Weird Al fan now. And I don't know if musicologists or people that study music are supposed to admit that they lack a certain objectivity. But I think people always have these interesting relationships to their subjects. So I'm just being honest. I'm a big Weird Al fan now. I think in a way I was always a Weird Al fan, but I didn't know it. So growing up, I was very involved in classical music and I thought I wanted to be an opera singer or something like this. And I studied voice and piano forever. And then I went into a conservatory of music in undergrad and really thought maybe I would be a singer before I decided to major in music history and really got involved with writing about music. So I just wasn't really aware fully of what was happening in pop music. I do remember seeing the video for Smells Like Nirvana with Weird Al. I think it was a video on MTV that my brother had put on. I probably wanted to watch Murder, She Wrote, which is still an argument we have. But so I was aware of Weird Al, but I just wasn't fully paying attention to anything but classical music for a long time. But once I got involved with this topic, I really wanted to write. I've always written about categories in music. I've written about these kind of essential ideas of Jewish music and even ideas of music itself, that it has to be uplifting. I took that on in my book about music and criminal law, that music can be positive, it can be negative, it can be everything in between. So then I decided I wanted to take on the idea of humorous music, that humorous music is somehow dismissed in comparison to serious music. And that seemed like a huge problem and something right up my alley. And Weird Al seemed the obvious choice to explore. And when I was able to get an interview with him, I was off and running and really throwing myself into the music. And then I realized, oh my gosh, this is a fabulous place to live. I'm a fan. And that's kind of the journey.
It might seem to an outsider like there's quite a leap from heavy topics like Jewish music during the Nazi era and music and criminal law to humorous music, much less the music of Weird Al. Did you perceive a through line yourself, or did it feel like a leap?
Yes. Well, I realize when I say it, when I was first working on the book and I told people I got a lot of these quizzical looks. So it sounds like a leap when people know I worked on music during the Nazi era, and now I'm working on a book about Weird Al. It sounds like a leap, and I realize that. I realize that my CV now almost looks like some sort of punchline. You've got this left turn with these very serious topics, and then boom, Weird Al. And I kind of love that. But for me, there is a through line with this categories. I'm taking on these, always taking on these issues in music where people are sticking a certain type of music in a box and not realizing how dynamic music is, or the people behind the music, how dynamic they are. So I was able to do that with this humorous music. Humorous music is seen as somehow less than serious music when it takes a tremendous amount of talent to create something that's funny. There's a wonderful quote that I'm going to be using for a forthcoming book from this humorous musician named Insane Ian. And he told me that it takes a musician to write I don't have the quote in front of me, but the gist was, it takes some talent to write a love song, but to write a love song about a burrito, now that's really something.
That speaks to one of the questions that I had when I was reading your book, is how to categorize Weird Al. Is he a comedian using music as his sort of vector for comedy? Is he a musician that happens to write funny songs? Is he an entertainer? Like, how do we think of him? There's something like old fashioned vaudevillian, multi-talent about how he presents himself.
Yeah. And I think he's all those things. I think it's easy when someone plays the violin, just the violin, not to minimize it with the just. I'm very sick of the justs always are a problem. But it's very easy to categorize that person as a musician. They're playing an instrument. Boom. Weird Al does all these things. So you start to go, well, what is he really? He is all of those things. He is an entertainer. He's obviously a musician. He can crush it with the accordion. And his voice doesn't always get the respect it deserves. I think initially especially earlier in his career, he leaned into this kind of nasal quality and for a comedic effect. There's, of course, a lot of great musicians that have a kind of nasal quality. But Weird Al also has some tremendous skill with that voice that I only kind of appreciated after a while. I started to realize, wow, he's really got range. He can imitate a lot of different styles. He can embed himself in a lot of different styles. And he's got some really kind of impressive high notes that come out once in a while. He's definitely a musician. He does all of those things. He's knows a lot about music technology. He knows how to recreate certain aspects of these original songs and what to do there. He's involved in all of these different aspects of music making. He's very hands-on with all of that. Even with the orchestration for his Strings Attached tour, he worked with the arranger that was helping move his music from the initial instruments to an orchestra. So he does it all, and he is all those things, and that's okay.
It does seem, it was really fascinating to me as a musical practitioner to get a glimpse into his technique as a craftsman. He seems very proud of his hands-on quality, in terms, especially around the linguistic strategies. You're sort of matching the syllabic accents of the originals that he's parodying and so on.
His process is really interesting. You think he might just be, I don't know why, people think parody is easy, it's something children can do, but to really do it well, the amount of work that goes into how he chooses his words is remarkable, draft after draft, careful consideration, his zombie-like state he describes. He's great with words. And that's something I found out in difficult ways when I sent him the book, which was not required. It wasn't in the contract that I had to show him the book before it came out. But I went ahead and did that. And he found some grammatical errors, and he would be a great editor. Yeah, he's great with words.
I also like that he doesn't take suggestions. I feel like there's a lot of like armchair weird owls out there saying, oh, you should write such and such a parody.
Oh, yeah. Well, everyone thinks they have an idea that's great and Weird Al. And I guess that's changed his style, because there's so many people that can just put up some sort of parody on YouTube. he has to think it through and not go with the most obvious idea. But he did take one suggestion, and that was from Madonna, since it's Women's History Month. I love that the only parody suggestion he ever took was from Madonna, turning her like a virgin into like a surgeon.
Let's talk about parody as a sort of genre and why it gets dismissed. You know, there's this idea that parody is a derivative. I think you use the word parasitic, that
right.
Real genius is supposed to create from nothing. There's also the question of ownership. It seems like he must be sort of at the forefront of some special challenges of permission and copyright.
Yeah, the legal history behind parody is really interesting. And he was a big fan, or is a big fan, of Mad Magazine. And there were some early parody writing in there that did get challenged legally. But now the courts do recognize parody as fair use. So he's able to do it. He does ask permission. He doesn't have to ask permission legally or get permission legally. Because parody is recognized as an art form, as it should be. When you look back through music history, parody has always been a part of music, and music builds on existing work. All art builds on existing work. You could almost make an argument that anything is a parody. Parody, by definition, you're taking a pre-existing work and making it new somehow. So there's an argument that an awful lot of art is parody. But in music history, you have so much of music, like early music, dealing with original music, putting new words on that music, like the motet way back when. You're taking existing music, changing the words, combining the music in different ways. There's such a long history of using pre-existing work, and it is considered an art form legally now, as well it should be.
You point out that the national anthem is a parody.
Yes, yes. It takes real talent to do parody well and to make a new point with it. That's all creative artwork, and shouldn't be seen as something that's derivative or parasitic. This is how art moves.
You just answered one of the questions that kept coming up reading your book, which is, you know, there's one of the repeated stories that keeps coming up with Weird Al is that the management will refuse permission, but then the artist will okay it. The exception being Prince. I kept wondering, does he really need the permission? Why do you think it's so important to him to get the permission?
Well, Weird Al cares about his reputation, and he doesn't want to become a lightning rod for controversy and upset. That's just not who he is. That's not part of what he wants to do. So he's always been very respectful about artists' wishes. That was the same. There's so many examples of that, even with Eminem and the Couch Potato parody. He got permission to do that, but he didn't get permission to make a video for it. Somehow the image of Weird Al as Eminem wasn't something Eminem's team was okay with. So he didn't make the video. It's just, he doesn't want to be involved in these controversies. And it's that way in everything he does, in the topics he chooses, in his approach to politics or lack thereof. He doesn't want to be embroiled in these controversies. He's a source of joy.
But to clarify, he wouldn't have needed, if I understand correctly, he wouldn't have needed permission to do the visual
That's
parody
right.
either, right?
That's right. No, absolutely. Yeah, he could have done that, and he could have parodied Prince legally if he had wanted to.
His apolitical attitude is one of those things which maybe has sort of allowed him to have the longevity that he had. There's a way in which, and especially since he's become such a beloved pop culture figure in the last couple of years, the character he reminded me of a little bit was Dolly Parton, that they've
yes.
both managed to maintain this plausible deniability about their personal politics.
Yes, I love that you bring up Dolly Parton. It's such a great idea, and it wasn't something I thought of, but it makes perfect sense. Dolly Parton had an amazing career, especially as a woman. So many women, after a certain amount of time, come against these double standards and these labels that have, you know, that seem to just lurk behind every corner for women in music. You know, diva. There's so many. But Dolly Parton maintains this likability. And I thought of this article, I think it was by Emily Lordy, about how Dolly Parton is able to straddle these different categories. She can appear authentic and artificial, you know, very, very feminine, but also a strong, powerful feminist. And somehow that all works. They don't cancel each other out. And likewise, we've got Weird Al here, who's had this very long career and with the same group of musicians behind him. His band has been with him this whole time, which is, I mean, there's very few other bands that have been together for as long as Weird Al's group has been together. And he's remained beloved despite, you know, despite working in comedy, which, you know, comedy can kind of way into controversies just with the change in context, the changes over time and how we think. Yeah, it's amazing. I think it's partly how he approaches politics. He really is careful not to go too far. He doesn't want that to be part of his brand. And he's also, you know, asked for permission. He's got this very likable reputation and it's really well earned. Everyone who works with him talks about how nice it is to work with him, how attentive he is, how involved he is, how receptive to their ideas he is. And in writing this book, I found he was very nice. It was really amazing. I started when I first thought of this idea and got the interview, I was so excited. And then after I met him and he was so generous in our first interview and so engaged, he didn't have a cell phone out. He wasn't distracted. He was fully engaged in this interview, you know, and he offered me, you know, coffee or something, whatever I wanted. And I just couldn't ask him to get me coffee. he was just so lovely. And then afterwards, I felt this tremendous responsibility to do a good job with this book because he had been so generous and so nice. It's just, it really is kind of remarkable. Of course, if you ask him about his niceness, he will say, you know, the standards are low in Hollywood. I'm just, you know, just a regular sort of person. But it actually is really remarkable.
Yeah, I mean that's another thing that he and Dolly Parton have in common, right? Is their reputation for niceness. And I wonder if there's sort of a what the chicken and egg relationship is to their avoidance of controversy, and the reputation for niceness.
Yeah, I'm sure it's connected. Both of them have somehow waded through all of that, and it's just, I mean, it's so few stars you can even think of that get to a certain level of fame as kind of these icons and legends. And I would say Weird Al has hit that status, just the sheer amount of television shows or programs that cite him in some way. He pops up all over the place. Like, he is a legend at this point. And he somehow maintained that status. And there's very few stars that can wade through like that. And I'm sure the niceness relates.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but the one exception he seems to make in terms of political statements is about vegetarianism.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of why he carves out a space for that?
Well, it's important to him. I do realize it's important to him, and he's got that song Trigger Happy that takes on a gun ownership. He's not in favor of guns. Of course, the sentiment behind that song, You know, it's this trigger happy, I'm trigger happy. And it's kind of making fun of all of that. But some people misconstrued that and thought, you know, he actually is celebrating guns. But in that song, that is not the case. That's something that's important to him. He read a book, I believe it was in 1992, that set him on this course. And that is something that he cares about and sticks to.
You mentioned that one of the challenges as far as longevity for comedians is that comedy is sort of a famously perishable quality,
yeah.
Especially some of the lyrics. Can you talk a little bit about how he's avoided that particular challenge?
Yeah, that's interesting. I know he tries to avoid the political topics in part because it dates you. It's not just maintaining his kind of reputation, staying out of controversy. But it's also that the politics changed so quickly. If he had a bunch of songs that dealt with contemporary events like a Randy Rainbow, that stuff might not be relevant in a week or even the next day. So that's something he avoids. It's true that even with topics that seem like they might hold up, like grammar, his song Word Crimes, that the meaning can change. The meaning can change in any of these comedic setups. Our lives, the current state of things is just constantly changing. So he tries his best to have material that won't date itself immediately. But it's kind of amazing to see how sometimes that doesn't work out. I just last week saw a post from someone who was upset about his song Word Crimes because he mentions slowing down and paying attention to pronouns. What's the exact lyric? It's you've got to slow down. Sorry, I'm pulling it up so I don't mess it up, because I found it so fascinating. You'd better slow down and use the right pronoun. Now, that song is 2014. Someone was upset, like, oh, Weird Al, so woke, quote unquote, caring about, using the right gender pronouns. I'm sick of it. Some upset post. And I thought, wow, this post is so crazy on two levels. First of all, this song was 2014. I think the dealings with gender pronouns was kind of 2017. The first academic article, I think, is around 2017 dealing with that. And then it sort of took off around. I don't think the issue around gender pronouns was big in 2014. I'm fairly certain that's not what Weird Al meant. I'm not even taking on the political thing of how stupid it is that this guy is upset about pronouns, gender pronouns too. But the point is, this song is being received differently, again, when it's a seemingly innocuous topic around grammar. It's kind of amazing.
But it does seem like he gets the benefit of the doubt, again, because of his reputation.
Yes, that's true. He does. And he has made mistakes that he, inadvertent mistakes. He used the word spastic also in that song, and he didn't realize how much of a slur that was in the UK. And he apologized and felt very terrible, still seems to feel very terrible about that. And other words too, he kind of realizes they're not quite right and will mention that if he's going to play the song. I heard him do that with the word midget, in concert. But yeah, people seem to forgive him. There hasn't been any sort of attempt to, quote unquote, cancel him, if that even works. I'm not sure. He definitely gets the benefit of the doubt. He apologized. He sincerely apologizes, and people believe him.
One of the other extraordinary lines that he manages to walk is that, for someone who's been, by any definition, a celebrity for many, many decades, and, we've seen pictures of his house. He's a wealthy guy. Mm-hmm. People don't. He still manages to come across. You say his friends treat him like a friend, not a celebrity. Yeah. Like he plays this role of the one sane man in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah, he does, and you don't catch him doing any wild antics. He doesn't drink. He doesn't seem, he does have a nice house, but it doesn't seem excessive. And I read quite a few articles early on about him being quite, cheap, like with a, not an overspender, quite smart in that respect. I love this movie that's being made right now with Daniel Radcliffe playing him in a kind of parody of a biopic. I think some people think this movie is actually going to be the true story of Weird Al's life. I don't know if you've heard about this movie.
I did. I actually did think that. I thought I didn't realize it was a parody.
I think it's because you see the tagline. This is about the excess of Weird Al. Now, Weird Al doesn't have excess. He's not a big drinker or a big partier or crazy in these ways. So just that's a tip off. This is going to be a crazy version of the life that Weird Al never had because he wasn't out drinking and doing these crazy benders or involved with, you know, starlets in these wild romances. He has a lovely, stable home life and he doesn't drink. So I can't wait for this movie. This is going to be too much fun.
Yeah, it does seem like there's a way in which he presents himself, and you know, he's spiritually Midwestern, you know,
yeah,
like this small C conservative force.
Yeah, and he's talked too about his mom was very overprotective, and you know, growing up, and part of that was he was younger than the kids. He skipped several grades, so you know, bullying was an issue for him, and his mom watched out for him and also regulated on his musical choices. I guess he listened to the Dr. Demento show in secret because his mom heard a few kind of off-color songs and didn't approve. So yeah, he had parents that really watched out for him and took care of him, and he was on the straight path and has stayed there.
It did strike me as interesting talking about his early influences. We hear that he learned to play accordion by learning all of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road on the accordion. That's the only mention of non-comedy music. Do we have any sense of what other music he liked?
Yeah, that's interesting. He was definitely exposed to a lot of different things that influenced him. And again, the comedy music is music. So he was exposed to a lot of good music, being interested in the comedic musicians and Mad Magazine and all of this. But listening to the Dr. Demento show too, he was exposed to a lot of different stuff. Dr. Demento, you think of humorous music, but he also was very into rarities or music that was not getting the play that he thought thought it deserved. So Weird Al was exposed to a lot of different stuff. I cited Elton John and some of these comedic musicians kind of looking for the through line of his comedic influences, but he was exposed to a lot of different music also, just with Dr. Demento.
Yeah. We should talk about the accordion because he was so associated with that. And of course, you know, if you're going to be a comedic musician, no instrument in American culture, almost no instrument in American culture comes with as much comedic baggage as the accordion.
Yes. Yeah. The accordion is too much fun. And I know, you know, since you're an accordion player, that there's some fascinating mashups, but it seems like the accordion these days is also becoming somewhat hip depending. Would you say that's true?
I mean, I have this theory, of course, that, you know, because there was so many, it was such a culturally dominant instrument in the 40s and 50s with the Lawrence Welk show. And, you know, there were millions and millions of accordions sold and all those went into, you know, into attics for many decades. And when that generation started to die off and those pretty excellent instruments ended up on eBay pretty inexpensively, I think people our age and younger were able to acquire them and start playing around with them and play around with that cultural baggage, even as we picked them up.
Yeah. And I think it can make it a fun kind of source of something new and different and innovative. Now, at the time when Weird Al got this instrument, and he didn't really choose it, this was his mom, and there was a door-to-door salesman with this accordion, and Weird Al has joked tremendously that his mom wanted to make him tremendously popular with the ladies because this instrument did have all the baggage at the time when he was playing. And he immediately sensed that that was a rich source of comedy, you know, playing these popular songs on the accordion right away got people's attention. And Dr. Demento cited that early on as one of the reasons that Weird Al really caught his eye or caught his ear, was hearing the accordion in the mix in comedic music. That was something special. And he's played with that forever, the accordion in different ways, and always with the polka medleys. But yeah, I think now it's kind of fun to see or think about how the reception around the accordion in comedic music is changing, how there's something kind of hip about it almost. And it kind of almost dovetails with Weird Al's reputation, how he was so uncool and played with that. And then all of a sudden being a nerd, being uncool became cool.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to have a real eye for things like accordions, like the Hawaiian shirts, like the glasses for a while, you know, the things that are the opposite of the tropes of musical seriousness. Like what's more opposite to, you know, orchestral concert black than a Hawaiian shirt and an accordion?
Oh yeah. It's so true. I love how he plays with that. As I was working on this book and I came up with this title, Weird Al Seriously, which just right away seems like this strange mashup. But you know, it's not. And then I came up with this idea for the cover, and Kelly Phillips, this wonderful artist, did this cover I wanted a bust, kind of like the traditional composer bust of Beethoven, you know, very serious, but only it's Weird Al. And I thought that would be so funny and meaningful. And right at that time, then I heard about Weird Al's going to do his Strings Attached tour, where he's playing with an orchestra. And there's that funny mashup again, Weird Al with a symphony orchestra. He's always playing with that. And he has a great eye for how to play against that, even though in a way he plays with it. I love all of that.
We should talk about those polka medleys, because of course the accordion is totally central to those. Aside from the inherent comedy of transferring recognizable rock and pop songs to the accordion, is there more there with the what seems to be the ongoing fascination with these polka medleys?
Well, music wise, yeah, they're amazing. And you would appreciate that way more than me, because I do not play the accordion, although I really think I need to go on eBay, like you said, and pick up a cheap accordion and just get into it. Like the Hamilton polka, that is just impressive musically, just the sheer amount of notes. Even me, someone who does not play the accordion, gets that is impressive. But within the polka medleys, the mashup between the popular song and the accordion is hilarious and fun, but also the arrangement, the songs he chooses and how he fits them together can be very interesting. Which song bit comes after the other, and in the whole, in the way he combines these songs, there can be interesting commentaries and clashes and comedic send-ups just in that mashup. So the polka medleys are really fascinating when you kind of analyze it and take it apart in all of these ways, the song combination, the genre combination, and then the musicianship. So there's actually a ton happening at once in those things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
As an example of the, I think you present as a kind of example of how he might be making a commentary on a style of popular music, I think you call it the Sad White Boy medley.
Oh, Angry White Boy Polka.
Angry White Boy Polka.
Yes, exactly. That's one. And he's got one that matches up a lot of songs dealing with women, too. It's something I talk about in the chapter dealing with gender. That's really fascinating, these kind of powerful women coming together in song. And sometimes, too, he'll take little bits of songs that are kind of similar, like a repetition in a consonant that happens in several different songs, and put that together, kind of these similarities between the pop songs. And you can look at that almost as a commentary on the standardization of pop music, or not. But it's interesting how he chooses the songs and both the commentary, what he says about a certain topic, but also the construction of pop song.
I mean, maybe there probably is something inherently, there's an inherent critique, but just by saying, look at all these songs about angry, you know, American masculinity that are popular right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that. It's something, when I came up with a proposal for the Weird Al book initially, I had set chapters. I did this deep dive into the music, and then I had, okay, here are some themes that I see that I'm definitely going to talk about. I didn't think of gender. That was the only chapter that came later after spending a lot of time with the topic. I was like, oh my gosh, look at this connection around gender. And it's kind of interesting. He doesn't draw attention to it, but you see this come up again and again around masculinity and toxic masculinity and strong women. He's often flipping songs that are quite toxic in these kind of hilarious ways and saving songs. I'll mention Word Crimes again with that blurred lines. We've got these dancing naked women with Robin Thicke that then become dancing punctuation marks. And it's just a wonderful commentary on the ridiculousness of the original and almost the danger. But it's not something he draws attention to. So it was almost a surprise to me when I started to see this topic of masculinity and toxic masculinity flipped and made ridiculous over and over.
I mean, I guess there is the question of whether identifying tropes is quite the same as critiquing tropes, or just putting them out there for public display.
Yes, I think that's a good point. I think he does draw attention to them in interesting ways, but it's arguably a critique. That's one of the fun things about parody. You can look at it in so many ways. Someone else is going to listen to the Trash Day, which is this flip of Nelly's Hotten here. Someone's going to hear that in a completely different way maybe than I did. But I think the critique and commentary is there. You've got this duet, or you've got this, in the original, this it's getting hot in here, take off all your clothes. And then this very robotic woman, yes, I'll take off all my clothes, you know, this kind of gross male fantasy. And then it becomes this bickering between a man and a woman, and the man doesn't want to take out the trash, and the wife's like, come on, man, you're a disgusting slob, take it out. And it's just a delightful flip, and it's hard for me not to hear it as a critique, but parody leaves a lot of those questions open.
And it's another one of those really narrow hoops that Al has to jump through, because the song ultimately has to be funny in terms of his longevity. It has to be funny even if you don't know the source, even if the source song has been forgotten.
Yes, no, absolutely. And so that's part of why parody plays in so many different ways. If you're familiar with the original, you're going to hear the song different than if you haven't heard the original. And Weird Al wants it to be funny if you haven't heard the original. And it is, you've got these little barf sounds in that. There's all kinds of goofiness and very descriptive ruminations on the actual trash. So that's part of the reason parody plays in so many different ways. And Weird Al wants you to be able to appreciate the song, even if you don't know the original. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. That said, he does put a lot of, you know, he made a move at a certain point in his career from playing his parodies just on accordion or accordion with a little bit of accompaniment to actually trying to forensically recreate the original production.
Yeah. He had this idea that it was more funny if you didn't at first know it was a parody. If you actually start listening to it and think it's the original, and then boom, the lyrics come in and you go, oh, hold on. So the left turn is really emphasized there, where you're like, whoa, wait a second. That's something that became more important to him over time, being more consistent to the original.
And then you get the benefit of the catchiness and the whatever the eccentricities of the production are of the original, even if the original is no longer recognizable.
Oh, absolutely. For me personally, he saved a few songs, the songs that I just didn't want to hear anymore, but I liked the the beat. I liked the kind of melodic hook. I liked them, but I just didn't like the artist. I didn't like the sentiment, like Blurred Lines. He saved Blurred Lines for me. That's fun. That's super catchy. Now I can enjoy it. I would say Taco Grande too. That Rico Suave, the original, is pretty gross. And then Weird Al turned it into a whole thing about how delicious Mexican food is. And, you know, I agree, delicious. So he saved that one.
Who could argue?
Yeah. Who could? I'm with you.
Yeah. Do we know if his early fans noted or commented or cared about that switch from the more stripped down version to the more elaborate productions?
That's interesting. I never asked. I should have asked. Yeah, that's a great question. That's something now I'm going to ask after the fact. And it's going to be one more thing I wish I had gotten in the book. The great thing about doing an expanded edition, I had never done one before, was getting to put in all these things that as soon as I sent the original book off, I thought, gosh darn it, why didn't I do this?
It's every author's dream to get another crack at it.
I know. I've never had that. Have you ever had that experience? It's amazing.
Oh my God. It's the worst. There's nothing for finding typos and factual errors than sending off a final manuscript.
It's so true. You're so involved in that first process and you think you've covered everything. You're just done. You send it off. And then as soon as you do that, it somehow wipes the slate clean. And then you think of everything you should have included. For me, I can't believe that I did not talk about all of the people Weird Al influenced in the hardback version. I talked about people that influenced him. I talked about his legacy in music, but I didn't talk specifically about the many, many people he influenced. And not just musicians, comedians, there's a magician. There's so many different people that have been influenced by Weird Al in different ways. And I cannot believe I did not include that. So now I got a whole second crack at that and got to add a section called School of Al. And I got to make this really terrible joke. You know, it's a bad joke when it's really, really hard to explain. I did a whole thing around the second Viennese school, kind of. So a school of Al, you know, this, it's not an actual school. It's a sphere of influence. No one rides the bus. You know, another one rides the bus. That was a bad one. That's not even the worst joke I make in this section. I did a thing like the second Viennese school, you know, Viennese is Wiener, spelled like Wiener. And I somehow connected that to the Twinkie Wiener sandwich that Weird Al is known for. It was such a bad joke. The editor was like, I don't know what to do with this. If you really want to keep this, we can. I was like, can't, yes, I'm sorry.
Well, here's your chance. Who do you see being in the School of Al?
Oh my gosh, there's so many people. Well, I have this magician in there, but all like the comedic musicians, I had to do like The Lonely Island. The Lonely Island was very clear, and they've really cited him as an influence over and over again. And there's even this great magazine cover with them all drinking Kool-Aid, the Weird Al Kool-Aid, like as if this is not a School of Al, but an actual cult of funny music. I said The Flight of the Conchords. You've got Reggie Watts. I didn't say There Might Be Giants. I'm giving away that I have talked to you before, but that would have been something to explore. I did talk about a musician named Logan Whitehurst that was really influenced by Weird Al and The Might Be Giants. He died young, but Dr. Demento cited him as kind of, if there ever was going to be another Weird Al, that would have been it. Logan Whitehurst was really influenced by Weird Al. He also happens to have grown up with my husband, so it's kind of a wild connection. Who else did I put in there? Oh, Rachel Bloom. There's some amazing women that were influenced by Weird Al. There's Garfunkel and Oates. So yeah, all kinds of musicians and comedians. Jimmy Fallon talks about him. Lin-Manuel Miranda, I have yes. to mention. Just there's a quite a list.
I want to read out that Lin-Manuel Miranda quote because I think it really is insightful about what he's talking about, the polka medleys. Showing him that, quote, genre is basically just clothing that dresses up the song. A song could be any genre at all, and the song is not the genre. First of all, it's an amazing way to explain to some of my students when I'm trying to explain how songwriting copyright works and the difference between the song and the, you know, the publishing copyright and the master recording. But also it says something about a sort of platonic ideal of song that can project through whatever trappings of genre are draped over it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And to hear Lin-Manuel Miranda talk about all that and talk about Weird Al as the inspiration for that and the inspiration for what he did with Hamilton and how he's played with genre and the mixing of genres in his own work and how that all comes back to Weird Al. That's amazing. And I just love that, especially as someone who loves to play around with music categories. And you know, we get so rigid in how we think of genres and how we think of music, and to see that play that exists really just laid bare by people like Weird Al and Lin-Manuel Miranda is just, I love it. Chef's kiss.
Yeah. And that legacy that you're describing, the people who attach themselves to the legacy of Weird Al, is interesting because, you know, one of the things that I noticed in the early chapters was the difficulties I think people had with finding people to compare him to.
Yeah.
You know, we brought up They Might Be Giants. I don't think they were, I think they were just sort of traveling on parallel tracks, right? The other people carrying the torch for funny music with accordion in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
The name Frank Zappa came up a couple times.
Oh, yes.
Which is not exactly a flattering comparison to Weird Al. And they're sort of like, they operate in very different realms. Like Zappa self-consciously wants to project his seriousness in many ways.
Right.
And the humor is juvenile, and Weird Al, you know, has a very different viewpoint.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really hard to make those direct comparisons. And Frank Zappa, yeah, he's a funny one. He's a hard one to talk about for me in some ways because people do take him seriously. He, in the musical realms, in the musicological realms, he really wanted that serious cred, and he positioned himself as a sort of genius, and people agreed. But the way he went about that, when I read the biographies and all of this, he was sometimes, you know, sounded rather cruel and like some sort of bullying, and his music, some of the funniness in it is very cutting. It's very different than Weird Al in my mind. I don't think Weird Al would say that. He would welcome the comparison. He wouldn't be so cruel as I'm being right now to say, you know, Frank Zappa was a bully, and I don't see the connection there.
And it's an object lesson in humor that doesn't age well.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And I think Weird Al played with things in a different way. You know, Frank Zappa really wanted to be a part of the serious establishment and orchestral music. And when Weird Al comes in contact with an orchestra, he's playing with a mashup. He's not trying to say, I belong here. It's just, it's a very, very different. Yeah, it's hard to compare Weird Al to anyone. And yet we keep trying.
But I think the point being that, you know, Weird Al is coming from an unfamiliar place when he arrives on the scene, but his influence and his legacy is such that now there's a whole world of people that you can say, well, this is the world, this is the ocean that Weird Al swims in.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that his nerd status has become cool has certainly helped people to feel comfortable claiming him. And also I think it was Jimmy Fallon who had this quote in the expanded edition about Weird Al opening up this possibility that this is okay. It's okay to be so different, to do this weird stuff. And that's a powerful message, not just for these comedians and these musicians and all of these creative people, but for everyone. I mean, in some ways, everyone can talk about, well, not everyone, but anyone who's embraced their oddballness can cite Weird Al as an influence. I feel like I am at this point, you know, just when I'm being my oddball self, like, yeah, this is something Weird Al says it's okay, so it's okay.
Uh-huh. And in his humility and in his the unique place he occupies in the culture, he's constantly being discovered. It gives him this, it allows him to maintain this underdog quality well past any objective metric for underdog status, right? You say that there's a way in which every album is received as a comeback album, as a surprise, as a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, I love this. And I didn't talk about that as somehow a part of his longevity, but it makes so much sense that he was never seen as someone that was oversaturating the world of music, because he was always on this comeback, even though he never left. So it kind of made it possible for him to be there all of this time. People never resented it. It's Weird Al's still here. He's been here forever. I can't take it. No, they're always like, oh, he's back again. How lovely.
So the through line in your work is categories in music, from, again, Jewish music in the Nazi era, music and criminal law, Weird Al and humorous music. Where is that thread going to lead you next?
That is a good question. I am working on a book. It's under contract with the University of Indiana Press about funny music more generally, taking it on based on genre. So the musicians that took on the humor in heavy metal music, like Tenacious D, and the women who took on humorous music around musicals, and all of this. So I've got that book. I'm calling it Funny Music Seriously currently. I've had a lot of fun with that. I was able to get an interview with Tom Lehrer, who is notoriously reclusive.
Amazing.
Because it was amazing. I wanted to do a chapter about funny music and death. So I'm also doing some around topic chapters around humor and certain topics like love songs and death. And when I wrote to him, he said, I will talk to you, even though I don't really do interviews, as long as we stay on the topic of death. It was such an amazing response that it's just close to my heart forever. So I've got that. I also have been dealing with topics around gender and music. And I have a biography that came out a couple years ago about a woman, a female musicologist, and all of the challenges she dealt with those various labels. And I have another project dealing with labels, toxic labels that female musicians deal with in pop music. So, so yeah, you've got all of that hopefully to look forward to.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real treat.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.